Here we are again. Welcome back to Soul Practice, Raw Conversations, Real Practices. I'm Phyllis Mathis.
And I'm Kathy Escobar. And it's just fun to hang out with people and talk about interesting things.
Yeah.
And that's what we've been doing. But today we are back, just Phyllis and I.
It's always nice to just hang out and do our thing.
It is. We just walked and had a really good conversation just about so many different things.
Yeah, big things.
Yeah, life and pain and community and humaning and all the things. We do a lot in a 3-mile loop.
Yeah.
And Raina comes along and we're just always fascinated too by Raina, like how dogs are like humans.
Yeah. And how either she's interested or not in other dogs, but always interested in humans.
Yeah.
In you know, the most embarrassing ways that dogs have
to want to get to know a human. Leave them alone. They don't want to talk to you. Yeah. Oh my gosh.
Actually, crotch sniffing is not a thing for humans who don't know each other.
It works with your canine friends. this is a conversation that I have wanted to have for a long time, and I'm glad we finally kind of queued it up. We talk about it a lot, and it comes up a lot in, for sure, at the refuge, and for sure in traveling with people who are trying to get more free. And it is about toxic skills. Okay, so sometimes when people hear that, they're like, oh, it's like horrible things that we need to get rid of. It's actually just the opposite.
Superpowers nobody needs to have.
Yeah, that's exactly it. And I first heard the word from our friend Deborah Lloyd.
Yeah.
And I met Deborah at the very beginning of the refuge. She lives in Portland, and her husband Ken just had a super interesting ministry and spiritual community life. And we just met them at the perfect time. And he travels with a lot of people who live outside in Portland. And they had a community called The Bridge. And then it evolved. And our friend Angie Fadel actually started pastoring when Deborah retired. They were already pastoring. But, you know, everyone's connected is kind of my point.
Yeah. It's a small world, too.
It really is. But I was just such a gift to meet them all those years ago. And so she is a coach also. So she does a lot of coaching, a lot for people in ministry, but not only. And one of her, she has a book called My Vocational Credo. And she came to the refuge, this is a chunk of years ago now, and did a workshop on your vocation. And vocation is different than profession.
Yeah.
And vocation is, you know, what basically what you're called to do and live out in different ways. And so I don't get into any of these things, but I had one that just stuck out to me in such a strong way. And that is noticing where we are operating out of toxic skills. And toxic skills are things that you know how to do and you're actually really good at that you should not be doing, because they are not life-giving. They are draining.
Yeah.
And so
they're not actually helping too. I don't know. Are they?
It's hard to say. I mean, that's like maybe a piece of the conversation, because, you know, sometimes I think a lot of people benefit from my toxic skill.
Well, that's true.
And so, because, you know, a huge toxic skill that I have is actually like, I am a hacker. So I can figure out things and do things on the computer with technology, with administration, with things that are on the underside that nobody knows that I'm doing, that I truly shouldn't be doing.
For the organization.
For the organization. Yeah. Okay. For the refuge. And so like, this is a toxic skill that emerged yesterday. And a few people have heard the story last night at our volunteer appreciation party, but this is true. And I actually was at King Soopers picking up the chicken for a volunteer appreciation party that we had. We had so many people. Oh my gosh, it was over 80 people came to this party. So it was a lot of chicken.
Did you buy
150 pieces of fried and baked chicken? Okay, so the refuge is almost 17 years old. I have been buying chicken for 17 years. And so what is that? I have the Refuge credit card. So it's like part of it. Not everybody has that. And then Mike doesn't like chicken. Sometimes I feel bad because Mike Herzog does so many other toxic skills, honestly, that take care of things. But the truth was, I was in the grocery store picking it up and I was like, you know, I'm not sure I should be doing this. Maybe I should have had somebody else do this consciously. Okay.
Somebody else who doesn't have all kinds of other details in mind to pull off the celebration.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And I could have. This is the thing about toxic skills. It takes time to find somebody else to do it.
Yeah.
And so anyway, I'm there.
It's easier to do it yourself.
Yes. And this goes back to so many things, you know, about Enneagram 2s and codependency and just women getting shit done. You know, it's has a lot of threads to it. But truth was, I got the chicken. I was feeling pretty like taking care of my body. I did not feel super stressed. I felt pretty anchored. I had time. And I got it and I loaded it all in the car. And then I had these balloons and they were in these bags. And so when I stuck them in this car, and it's a car I don't normally drive because it's for water heels. And I couldn't see through the back because of the balloons. So I just pull out and I'm like starting to listen to Boxers. I turn on Indiana, which is this really big road that goes north and south, right by the grocery store and by our house and on the way to the Refuge. And all of a sudden I look in the rear view mirror and four of the six chickens flew out of the back.
These are dead cooked chickens. They're not like
dead cooked chicken blew out the back. And it's a busy road. Yeah. And I realized that the back was open. And so I pulled over and I was like, are you fucking kidding me? And then I'm like, I don't know what to do. I don't want to get hit by a car.
It's a very narrow road. Hardly has any shoulder. I don't even know where he pulled over because
it was right there. It was hard. And then I was like, I feel really bad. There are these four like aluminum, big, huge things. So I looked and I went and I grabbed really quick what was out there. And then I called Mike and what should I do? Da, 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 da. So, I mean, it was pretty funny, but it wasn't. And honestly, I probably shouldn't have been picking up the chicken.
Maybe not.
Maybe not. And so I just like wanted to bring it to the forefront and I want to hear more because I know you have a lot of toxic skills. And this is what happens when you're good at something. So I'm not saying, and I am good. I'm actually good at logistics. And I actually am really good at figuring certain things out. And I'm also good at seeing what needs to get done and just finding a way to do it and make sure. My thing is always that everyone's kind of taken care of. Ultimately, that's what it was like. Oh, okay. I don't have to bother anybody. I can have good food at the party. Yeah. I mean, I can rationalize all the things. The problem is with toxic skills is that in the end, they don't fill up. They empty. Yeah. Like they deplete us. And I think part of my clarity this year is to just really notice what are these things that I know I should not be doing that I'm actually doing. So,
for me, it's hard to discern. Well, I just want to say this out loud. I mean, I like the term toxic skills or superpowers better than I like the term profound codependency.
Which, good point.
For me, it is. I mean, for me, it is because it's mostly, so my toxic skill is, I like to call it, my superpower is attunement, which is like being able to get into the groove of whoever's in the room, you know, just sort of attuning to them in a way that, I don't know, I'm on their wavelength. Yeah. And so, Ted will sometimes, he'll say, I can tell who you're talking to on the phone because you sound just like them when you talk to them.
Oh,
and I'm like, shut up. I don't need to hear that.
Shut your mouth.
But it's kind of nice. I mean, in a way it's kind of nice and it certainly has served me, but along with that comes the extra piece that's super toxic for me, which is when I attune to them, then I think that I know what they want from me. And then that is my mission for the moment, is to not disappoint them, to give them what I think they want from me, which is, you know, total projection, I'm sure, but I'm not often wrong either. So I just start tap dancing for them. I just start, you know, just offering it to them. And it's nice sometimes in friendship to know that, to kind of sense what people need and to be able to sidle up beside them and have a really nice back and forth conversation. But it's gotten me burned out professionally 3 times in my career, where instead of, you know, staying in my own space, in my own body, in my own heart, I'm like reading what they want and making sure that they get it. And it's hard to discern what is an actual therapist's job besides that. And of course, I didn't get the greatest training. I just was a natural. So I just, that's what I did. And people love it, turns out, you know?
Yeah.
And it was always really nice for me. When I first started working as a therapist, it was actually before I was trained as one, but training didn't make that much difference, honestly. But I had a mentor who gave me an office, limited me to 50 minutes per session. And I remember after I did that, like, oh my gosh, I feel so free. I can sit in a room, and when it's over, it's over. And then I'm free. But I couldn't figure out that maybe there's something wrong with that. You know, this ability to kind of offer people what they need from my life force. So I was always handing out parts of my life force based on what I thought they needed, which is a whole lot different than what, you know, holding space for people in their stuff is, but it's hard to discern. Yeah. So I think I built my whole early career on that, burned out, thought I would never go back, picked it up again, started doing it again, burned out again, you know, so it's like, oh, maybe something's a little off about that. And so not just in my job, but in friendships too, you know, just being what people wanted me to be and not noticing until I like melt down and trash the relationship because I can't take it anymore, and not realizing until a long time afterwards that, yeah, maybe you had something to do with that.
Yeah.
Maybe you were operating out of toxic skills of saving people, being safe for them, offering them the support that they need, that they, I think they want, and which is different than having a real friendship. So that's mine. And I pay the price for that. And I'm trying to discern that all the time.
Yeah. And when I'm listening to you, I think the part about it is that it is our reflex. Mm-hmm. So it, you know, that's you as an Enneagram 9, like it's just, and you're good at it. Like, this is true, but it's like, it just happens naturally. You're not even thinking and it's happening. And that, oh, go ahead.
Oh, well, and it would start to make me panic. I think with that, it was like, I felt like it was all up to me. Mm-hmm. It's up to me. If someone has, I remember this back in our church days, there was somebody who wanted to come to our church who was clearly, had a lot of complex trauma, was probably dissociative identity disorder, reached out to the pastor. The pastor was like, oh, you need to be in Phyllis's home group. And then he told me about it, you know, and so I called this woman and I could tell just talking to her that she had a lot of really serious issues and that she was going to be in our home group. And I was the point person. And I felt that she could suck me dry, like mm-hmm. that I could feel it. And I was like, I was panicking like all the way home, like, oh my God, oh my God. I was flipping out because I felt like it was up to me to make sure that she felt safe, but she's going to zero in on me and she's going to want to come home with me. You know, I could feel it on the phone. And why is this always happen? And all of that stuff. So Ted goes, you know, you don't have to take all the responsibility. You don't have to fix her, right? You know, you don't have to. There are other people who can kind of help with her. And it never occurred to me. Never occurred to me. So yeah. I walked in the room and I just thought, I can just be a regular person here. I don't have to be the savior. I don't have to take her in a back room while the rest of the group is doing the group, which I need to belong to. You know, instead, I'm having to do psychotherapy and crisis management and emergency services in the back room while everybody else is doing their thing. Like, but the amount of panic that I had, and the amount of which came from my own compulsion to be responsible for everything and everyone, and how it just made me panic. And I never questioned that deeply rooted codependency, which is
profound.
I have to do it. It's all up to me. And I didn't even do a very good job. I mean, some people have toxic skills that they could do all day long and they do a great job of it. But mine after a while was just not helping anybody.
Yeah. And that, you know, it is just, I think it comes from a routineness and then a thing inside of us that says somehow we have to.
Yeah.
Somehow we have to, and we need to. Mm-hmm. And, you know, for me, it is really gotten me into a lot of trouble. And part of my work, and this is like why for soul practice, you know, these are raw conversations and real practices to hopefully be more healthy in our bodies and in the way we're moving in the world. And one of the best things that happened to me, and it's an ongoing thing, I'm going to always wrestle with toxic skills. And I think because I can do certain things and I'm used to doing certain things and it is easier to do certain things. And again, a lot for me happens kind of on the administrative sort of back end gluey things that make something go. And, you know, basically like coming back to your thread, like, what is it? It's something deep inside from a long time ago that just got developed. That's what I always did. This is not me in my 50s.
Yeah.
This is me in my fives, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8. Like, this is what I knew how to do. And so to untangle from it really does take a lot of soul work, in my opinion. Of some really like listening, because my body does know. And that is the part of this work that I think has been helping me the most, is that I was kind of so out of whack with some things in my body that I just didn't even know the stress that I was feeling. And because I was so used to doing it. And when I was on my sabbatical, so, you know, the timeline is really hard for me because Jared died in 2019 and I was doing, you know, I've been doing this work for a long time before Jared died, but Jared's death was a clarifying grief like that is a clarifying thing. So it does like cut through it all.
Yeah.
And it simplifies things. Then COVID. Well, practicing came out, then COVID. So that was the season of 2020. And that was a rough year, you know, for everybody. Mm-hmm. And to be honest, some of my toxic skills were really strong in that time because we had to like pivot in such a significant way in the rough year.
Yeah, you guys scrambled.
We really did.
So hard.
And we did so well at it. But when I look back on it, we did it in community. It was not just me, but some of those things of like operating, and I'm thankful for it on one level because that Jose and I always say, both of us say this about us, is that it helped us survive in a way. Mm-hmm. You just cannot spend, you know, I don't know how many waking hours we have. What is it? 16 waking hours, just like barely breathing. Like you just can't sustain that. So you do need distractions. Mm-hmm. It helps. But then in 2020, when I went on sabbatical for 3 months, and as I was preparing for that, it really got revealed to me. And I had come a long way. That's what's hard. I had come a long way in the refuge community. in letting go of a lot of things. And, you know, 7 years ago, went through this big shift, and for sure 6 years. And so things were a lot more dispersed. But then when I had to write down what I did.
And how to prepare everybody to take the
job
that you were doing.
Oh my gosh, it was painful. And I was proud of certain things that I had let go of, but there was this whole other part that was really, really revealing. And I pushed it all out and I went on sabbatical for 3 months. And in those 3 months, you know, I finally had space. I couldn't use any skills. Nothing. You know, this is from this total privileged spot, mm-hmm. you know, but I really needed that space. And you know, when I went out, this is just in the simplest way, but I was like, I will never create a fucking refuge calendar in Pages or Canva ever again.
That's oddly specific.
No, it was, because actually, like, it was just nuts. I did that for that many years because we didn't have money. We couldn't pay anybody and nobody did it. Nobody knew how to do it. It was just easier to do it. I mean, I could kind of go on and on. And you know, I have not picked any of those things back up that were in that realm, mm-hmm. but I'm still picking up chicken. And so this is why I'm saying this out loud and why I like to process.
I'm sorry. I'm just like, hi, I'm Kathy Escobar, an ex chicken picker upper. You need a 12 step group for that, Kathy.
I mean, why I want to talk about it is that I think we all have these things.
Yeah.
And so what's underneath it all is, if I am really honest, there is a fear. And there is a fear. So there's kind of like, one of the fears is that it won't get done. Mm-hmm. But underneath that fear for me is sometimes expecting people to do too much. Like, I'm going to push people over the edge.
Yeah, yeah.
Because we're already really stretched in our community. We do a lot with a little in comparison to what some other organizations pull off. And I have this, like, a lot more money than us and a lot more staffing. And so I'm afraid. So instead of, like, owning my limitation, I just do it mm-hmm. to cover. And my body doesn't want to keep doing that. And so even though I've let go of a lot, I'm painfully aware of how many things I continue to do out of fear. And what, when you said profound codependency, you know, what's underneath it all always is fear.
Yeah.
Of losing relationship, of rocking the boat, of somehow disrupting whatever is helping us be okay.
Yeah.
And we all have them. And so if you're listening, it's like, you know, what are those things that you're doing, that we're doing, that we kind of know as we're getting more in touch with our souls, that they're just not good for us, but we're trying to learn how to live with letting them go and then recognizing how hard that is. I mean, we're laughing about chicken, but the truth is that these are things that kind of help us survive. But they will not help us be free.
It's also tricky because since we learned these skills pretty early on, I think our bodies always can feel it when we're doing something that we don't want to, that we shouldn't be doing or exercising that in some way, but we spend our life overriding those signals from our bodies until we start becoming more aware.
Yeah.
And then you don't realize what you've been doing till your body starts to shout at you or till it starts to break down or something. And then it's like one of those skills. It's hard to spot while you're in the middle of it. It's almost always after you experience freedom and what that feels like, that you're like, oh my gosh, what is this I'm feeling? Mm-hmm. Oh, it's freedom from obligation, or it's freedom from, you know, having to take care of every single thing.
Yeah.
And then you look back and go, oh, I've been doing this for so long. So it's part of the difficulty of recovering from that, is that you don't know you have a problem until you become aware of the problem. Sometimes you can't be aware of the problem until you're exhausted, broken down, or, you know, sad or burned out or something.
Yeah, that's such a good insight. And that's good. Instead of like being mad at ourselves, just understand that that's kind of how it works. But it does make me think too, in vocation, you know, is that it is really painful if too much of our day-to-day, whatever the day-to-day looks like, just has too much of that.
Yeah.
And not enough juice in what we really love to do. And I want to say, though, this is always, you know, honoring our privilege. Sometimes these conversations can be kind of privileged because there are certain ways that people, you know, have ability to make a change in their job or whatever the things are, because there's a safety net and some things. But my hope for everybody is that somehow, some way, we all find a way to just have less of that.
Mm-hmm.
And more of kind of what we're supposed to do in the world. And we can't sometimes do it in our quote unquote job, but if you can find other ways to do it. So you might have to over here, but if you have enough goodness in other relationships or other spaces or other places where you can feel that ease, the hard part is when it's in every area. And I do think about this for me, because, you know, raising 5 kids and all those things, it was a lot. I mean, Jose and I have really done a lot of processing of how in the hell did we do that? When some was, you know, you're just in survival mode all the time to just keep everyone fed and bathed and maybe, you know, like, and we're all the things. And that's one of the joys of when the kids grow up, you know, you just all of a sudden can like go, oh, what do I want? And what can I do? What, you know, what that space is. But ultimately, because toxic skills are defaults and reflexes, it can easily fill that space too.
Well, yeah. And then what I run into a lot with people that I talk to is that hyper-competent people who have toxic skills create environments out of necessity. Mm-hmm. And then everybody in the system relies on them to just do what they do, to overfunction.
Yeah.
So then everybody else is underfunctioning. And so when the overfunctioner gets tired, they get mad. And then it's like mad at everybody else that they're not pulling their weight, they're not doing their thing. And that's true. But it's like the paradox of the hyper-competent person is that everyone's grateful that they can do a lot, but then they create a system in which no one else has to do it. And then it burns them out. And then these people don't have any skills.
Yeah.
Because you did it all for them, you know? And so it's a rough transition to make, to not just be like, I'm so mad and you people are so ungrateful and I'm just going to quit, you know, that kind of stuff, instead of what real work is to just say, wow, I realize we're in this situation and I'm burned out. We got to do something new, or, you know, there's no easy way to solve it. I'm just saying that it becomes this double bind, because you, in a sense, you created it, you helped create it, and then it ate you. And then everybody else is like, we don't know what to do now.
Yeah,
I'm usually one of the ones that's like, I don't know what to do now.
That worked for me.
I'm not with you too, but like, yeah, I live with a hyper competent person. And so then I'm like this old and don't have basic skills, you know?
Yeah, no, it's so good. And I love remembering some of the stuff in Harriet Lerner's book, The Dance of Anger. Gosh, that's a good book.
Yeah.
And the underfunctioning and the overfunctioning, and that we all kind of have these relationships, but most of us have a tendency to do one or the other. Mm-hmm. And so for over functioners, You know, it's like, then I'm pissed off. Like that's, and I'm a two too. So I like gratitude and I do get it. I don't feel like I'm like hurting in the gratitude department, but especially in moments where like I bust my ass for something, you know, and then nobody notices. It's interesting, but it is on us. I mean, this is part of it. All roads always lead back to us, ourselves, mm-hmm. and no one is going to do that for us. And the reason why is because it's our work to do.
Yeah.
It's our work to do. And it's my work to be honest about my limitations and that, you know, I sometimes say I did that and I can't change time. I'm glad I did it. It was part of my healing story, but I'm really trying to be more clear that I can't anymore.
Yeah.
I just can't. And I don't think it's healthy. You just named mm-hmm. for everybody. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's healthy. In the end, the healthier we are individually, the healthier the system around us, whatever it is. I mean, I'm talking organizationally in this moment, but I'm not, because it's in families, it's in friendships, it's in all the things. And the beginning of the work for me was like testing, just not doing it and seeing what happens. So when I don't do certain things and I've let some things go and I've just said, I'm going to see if anyone even notices. Mm-hmm. That's how I'm going to evaluate if people go, hey, what happened about us needing to do that or whatever. And that's a sign mm-hmm. that I'm like carrying things that don't need to be carried. Because if nobody says anything, I think it might've been me thinking that it was something that needed to happen. So that is one, but we can stop doing something and people do notice. And then it's like, okay, well, I'm getting clarity that I am trying to change this. So we can change it overtly and then we can change it covertly mm-hmm. by stop letting go of some things that are not ours to do, even though we can do them.
Yeah.
All right. Toxic skills.
All right, glad we fixed that one.
Yeah. Like part of the whole thing. But we always end with just a last little thought for the soul on toxic skills.
Yeah, well, the first thing that occurs to me is that I always have this question, and I'm not sure everybody does, but it's, do I get to be me in this world? That's always my question. Or under what conditions do I get to be me? And that's what I'm always sort of brokering at this really deep level. And so I think the answer from the soul is, of course, you get to be who you are. And being who you are is your gift to the world. Being who you're not just makes everybody suffer. Yeah. So it takes courage to remember that we are uniquely who we are in the world, and we get to let that guide us and guide our decisions. And if the clearer we are with that, better off everybody is.
Yeah. So good. It's good. And I think on the practice side, it's just this one simple thing came to mind in this conversation, and that just is asking the question, what am I afraid of if I stop doing this?
Yeah.
That's it. Just pause, notice. And it will not be in the moment. It'll be afterwards when you notice in your body that like, geez, why did I just do that? Why did I pick that up? Why am I doing, what am I afraid of if I don't do it? And in everything in soul practice, this is not for people listening. This is for us.
Yeah.
We're in the thick of this. So yeah, thanks for being part. Look forward to hearing what might get stirred up.